A typical harvest yields multiple eggs, sometimes up to 10 or 12, and these eggs are fertilized by a man's sperm in a petri dish. The embryos are then grown briefly in an incubator before being implanted back into the uterus. But not all IVF embryos are implanted. Implanting more than 3 embryos is unusual and unsafe, and the spare embryos are typically discarded, or rarely, implanted into other women's bodies who carry such embryos as surrogate mothers. In 1996, having obtained permission from the University of Wisconsin, Thompson obtained 36 embryos from IVF clinics. 14 of them grew into glistening cellular spheres in the incubator. Using the technique that he had perfected on monkeys, the peeling away of the outer layers, the gentle coaxing of cell growth on feeders and nurse cells, Thompson isolated a few human embryonic stem cells. Implanted into mice, these cells were capable of generating all 3 layers of the human embryo, the primordial sources of all tissues, such as skin, bones, muscles, nerves, intestines, and blood. The stem cells that Thompson had derived from IVF discarded embryos recapitulated many features of human embryogenesis, but they still had a major limitation. Although they were capable of making virtually all human tissues, they would not efficiently generate some tissues, such as sperm and egg cells. A genetic change introduced into these ES cells could thus be transmitted into all cells of the embryo, except to the most important ones, the cells capable of transmitting the gene to the next generation. In 1998, soon after Thompson's paper had been published in Science, groups of scientists around the world, including researchers from the United States, China, Japan, India, and Israel, began to derive dozens of embryonic stem cell lines from fetal embryonic tissues in the hopes of discovering a human ES cell capable of germline transmission of genes. But then, with little warning, the field was frozen shut. In 2001, 3 years after Thompson's paper, President George W. Bush sharply restricted all federal ES cell research to the 74 cell lines that had already been created. No new lines could be derived, even from IVF discarded embryonic tissues. Laboratories working on ES cells faced stringent oversight and cuts in funding. In 2006 and 2007, Bush repeatedly vetoed federal funding for the establishment of new cell lines. Advocates of stem cell research, including patients with degenerative diseases and neurological impairments, thronged the streets of Washington, threatening to sue federal agencies responsible for the ban. Bush countered these requests by holding press conferences flanked by children produced by the implantation of discarded IVF embryos that had been brought to life via surrogate mothers. The ban on federal funding for new ES cells froze the ambitions of human genomic engineers, at least temporarily. But it could not stop the advance of the second step required to create permanent heritable changes in the human genome, a reliable, efficient method to introduce intentional changes in the genomes of ES cells that were already in existence. At first, this too seemed like an insurmountable technological challenge. Virtually every technique to alter the human genome was crude and inefficient. Scientists could expose stem cells to radiation to mutate genes, but these mutations were sprinkled randomly throughout the genome, defying any attempt to directionally influence the mutation. Viruses carrying known genetic changes could insert their genes into the genome, but the site of insertion was typically random, and the inserted gene was often silenced. In the 1980s, another method to introduce a directional change in the genome, flooding cells with pieces of foreign DNA carrying a mutated gene, was invented. The foreign DNA was inserted directly into a cell's genetic material, or its message was copied into the genome. But although the process worked, it was notoriously inefficient and prone to errors. Reliable, efficient, intentional change, the deliberate alteration of specific genes in a specified manner, seemed impossible. In the spring of 2011, a researcher named Jennifer Doudna was approached by a bacteriologist, Emmanuel Charpentier, about a conundrum that seemed at first to have little relevance to human genes or genomic engineering. Charpentier and Doudna were both attending a microbiology conference in Puerto Rico. As they walked through the alleyways of Old San Juan, past the fuchsia and okra houses with arched doorways and painted facades, Charpentier told Doudna of her interest in bacterial immune systems, the mechanisms by which bacteria defend themselves against viruses. The war between viruses and bacteria has gone on for so long, and with such ferocity, that like ancient conjoined enemies, each has become defined by the other. Their mutual animosity has been imprinted in their genes. Viruses have evolved genetic mechanisms to invade and kill bacteria, and bacteria have counter-evolved genes to fight back. A viral infection is a ticking time bomb, Doudna knew. A bacterium has only a few minutes to defuse the bomb before it gets destroyed itself. In the mid-2000s, a pair of French scientists named Philippe Horvath and Rodolphe Baringu stumbled on one such mechanism of bacterial self-defense. Horvath and Baringu, both employees of the Danish food company Danisco, were working on cheese-producing and yogurt-making bacteria. Some of these bacterial species, they found, had evolved a system to deliver coordinated slashes in the genomes of invading viruses to paralyze them. The system, a molecular switchblade of sorts, recognized serial offender viruses by their DNA sequence. The cuts were not delivered at random places, but at specific sites in viral DNA. The bacterial defense system was soon found to involve at least two critical components. The first piece was the seeker, an RNA encoded in the bacterial genome that matched and recognized the DNA of the viruses. The principle for the recognition, yet again, was binding. The RNA seeker was able to find and recognize the DNA of an invading virus because it was a mirror image of that DNA, the yin to its yang. It was like carrying a permanent image of your enemy in your pocket, or, in the bacteria's case, an inverted photograph etched indelibly into its genome. The second element of the defense system was the hitman. Once the viral DNA had been recognized and matched as foreign by its reverse image, a bacterial protein named Cas9 was deployed to deliver the lethal gas to the viral gene. The seeker and the hitman worked in concert. The Cas9 protein delivered its cuts to the genome only after the sequence had been matched by the recognition element. It was a classic combination of collaborators, spotter and executor, drone and rocket, Bonnie and Clyde. Doudna, who had been immersed in the biology of RNA for most of her adult life, was intrigued by the system. At first, she thought of it as a curiosity. "The most obscure thing I ever worked on," as she later put it. But working with Charpentier, she began to meticulously break it down to its constituent components. In 2012, Doudna and Charpentier realized that the system was programmable. Bacteria, of course, only carry the images of viral genes so that they can seek and destroy viruses. They have no reason to recognize or cut other genomes. But Doudna and Charpentier learned enough about the self-defense system to trick it. By substituting a decoy recognition element, they could force the system to make intentional cuts in other genes and genomes. Switch the seeker, they found, and a different gene might be sought and cut. There is a phrase buried in that last sentence that should send a restless ping of fantasy through the mind of any human geneticist. An intentional cut in a gene is the potential source of a mutation. Most mutations occur randomly in the genome. You cannot command an X-ray beam or direct a cosmic ray to selectively change only the cystic fibrosis gene or the Tay-Sachs gene. But in Doudna and Charpentier's case, the mutation was not delivered randomly. The cut could be programmed to occur exactly at the site recognized by the self-defense system. By changing the recognition element, Doudna and Charpentier could redirect it to attack a selected gene, thereby mutating the gene at will. The system could be manipulated even further. When a gene is cut open, two ends of DNA are revealed, like severed string, and the ends are trimmed back. The cutting and trimming is meant to repair the broken gene, and the gene then tries to recover the lost information by seeking an intact copy. Matter has to conserve energy. The genome is designed to conserve information. Typically, a cut-open gene tries to recover the lost information from the other copy of the gene in the cell, but if a cell is flooded with foreign DNA, then the gene witlessly copies the information from this decoy DNA rather than from its backup copy. The information written into the decoy DNA fragment is thus copied permanently into the genome, akin to erasing a word in a sentence and then forcibly writing a substitute in its place. A defined, predetermined genetic change can thus be written into a genome. The sequence ATGGGCCCG in a gene can be altered to ACCGCCGGG, or any desired sequence. A mutant cystic fibrosis gene can be corrected to the wild-type version. A gene to confer viral resistance can be introduced into an organism. The mutant BRCA1 gene can be reverted to wild-type. The mutated Huntington's gene with its mirthless sing-song repeat might be disrupted and deleted. The technique has been termed genome editing or genomic surgery. Doudna and Charpentier published their data on the microbial defense system called CRISPR-Cas9 in Science magazine in 2012. The paper immediately ignited the imagination of biologists. In the 3 years since the publication of that landmark study, the use of this technique has exploded. The method still has some fundamental constraints. At times, the cuts are delivered to the wrong genes. Occasionally, the repair is not efficient, making it difficult to rewrite information into particular sites in the genome. But it works more easily, more powerfully, and more efficiently than virtually any other genome-altering method to date. Only a handful of such instances of scientific serendipity have occurred in the history of biology. An arcane microbial defense, devised by microbes, discovered by yogurt engineers, and reprogrammed by RNA biologists, has created a trapdoor to the transformative technology that geneticists had sought so longingly for decades. A method to achieve directed, efficient, and sequence-specific modification of the human genome. Richard Mulligan, the pioneer of gene therapy, had once fantasized about clean, chaste gene therapy. This system makes clean, chaste gene therapy feasible. One final step is necessary to achieve the intentional permanent modification of the genome in human organisms. Genetic changes that have been created in human ES cells have to become incorporated into human embryos. The direct transformation of a human ES cell into a viable human embryo is inconceivable for both technical and ethical reasons. Even though human ES cells can generate all types of human tissues in a laboratory setting, it is impossible to envision implanting a human ES cell directly into a woman's womb in the hopes that the cell will autonomously organize itself into a viable human embryo. When human ES cells have been transplanted into animals, the most that the cells can achieve is a loose organization of the vital tissue layers of the human embryo, far from the anatomical and physiological coordination achieved by a fertilized egg during human embryogenesis. One potential alternative is to attempt the genetic modification of an embryo in toto, after it has achieved its basic anatomical form, that is, a few days or weeks after conception. This strategy is also intractable. Once organized, the human embryo becomes fundamentally obdurate to gene modification. Technical hurdles aside, the ethical qualms about such an experiment would vastly outweigh any other considerations. Attempting genome modification in a living human embryo obviously raises a gamut of questions that reverberate far beyond biology and genetics. In most nations, such an experiment lies beyond the conceivable boundaries of permissibility. But there's a third strategy that may be the most approachable. Suppose a genetic change is introduced into human ES cells using standard gene modification technologies. And now imagine that the gene-modified ES cells can be converted into reproductive cells, sperm and eggs. If ES cells are truly pluripotent stem cells, then they should be able to give rise to human sperm and eggs. A real human embryo, after all, generates its own germ cells, sperm or egg. Now consider a thought experiment. If a human embryo can be created by IVF using such gene-modified sperm or eggs, then the resultant embryo will necessarily carry these genetic changes in all its cells, including its sperm and egg cells. The preliminary steps of this process can be tested without changing or manipulating an actual human embryo, and can thus safely skirt the moral boundaries of human embryo manipulation. Most critically, the process mimics the well-established protocols of IVF. A sperm and an egg are fertilized in vitro, and an early embryo is implanted into a woman's body, a procedure that raises few qualms. It is a shortcut to germline gene therapy, a backdoor to transhumanism. the introduction of a gene into the human germ line is facilitated by the conversion of ESLs into germ cells. This final challenge was largely on its way to being solved exactly as Doudna was perfecting her system to alter genomes. In the winter of 2014, a team of embryologists in Cambridge, England, and at the Weizmann Institute in Israel developed a system to make primordial germ cells, the precursors of sperm and eggs, out of human embryonic stem cells. Earlier experiments using earlier versions of human ES cells had failed to create such germ cells. In 2013, Israeli researchers modified these earlier studies to isolate new batches of ES cells that might be more capable of forming germ cells. A year later, collaborating with scientists at Cambridge, the team found that if they cultured these human ES cells under specific conditions and shepherded their differentiation using specific coaxing agents, the cells would form clusters of sperm and egg precursors. The technique is still cumbersome and inefficient. Obviously, due to stringent restrictions in the creation of artificial human embryos, whether these sperm-like and egg-like cells can give rise to human embryos capable of normal development is yet unknown. But the basic derivation of cells capable of transmitting heredity has been achieved. In principle, if the parent ES cells can be modified using any genetic technique, including gene editing, genetic surgery, or the insertion of a gene using a virus, any genetic change can permanently and heritably be etched in the human genome. It is one thing to manipulate genes. It is quite another thing to manipulate genomes. In the 1980s and 1990s, DNA sequencing and gene cloning technology allowed scientists to understand and manipulate genes and thereby control the biology of cells with extraordinary dexterity. But the manipulation of genomes in their native context, particularly in embryonic cells or germ cells, opens the door to a vastly more powerful technology. What is at stake is no longer a cell, but an organism, ourselves. In the spring of 1939, Albert Einstein, mulling over recent advances in nuclear physics in his study at Princeton University, realized that every step required to achieve the creation of an unfathomably powerful weapon had been individually completed. The isolation of uranium, nuclear fission, the chain reaction, the buffering of the reaction, and its controlled release in a chamber had all fallen into place. All that was required was sequence. If you strung these reactions together in order, you obtained an atomic bomb. In 1972, at Stanford, Paul Berg stared at bands of DNA on a gel and found himself at a similar juncture. The cutting and pasting of genes, the creation of chimeras, and the introduction of these gene chimeras into bacterial and mammalian cells allowed scientists to engineer genetic hybrids between humans and viruses. All that was needed was the threading of these reactions into a sequence. We are at a similar moment, a quickening for human genome engineering. Consider the following steps in sequence. A, the derivation of a true human embryonic stem cell, capable of forming sperm and eggs. B, a method to create reliable, intentional genetic modifications in that cell line. C, the directed conversion of that gene-modified stem cell into human sperm and eggs. D, the production of human embryos from these modified sperm and eggs by IVF. And you arrive, rather effortlessly, at genetically modified humans. There's no sleight of hand here. Each of the steps lies within the reach of current technology. Of course, much remains unexplored. Can every gene be efficiently altered? What are the collateral effects of such alterations? Will the sperm and egg cells formed from ES cells truly generate functional human embryos? Many, many minor technical hurdles remain, but the pivotal pieces of the jigsaw puzzle have fallen into place. Predictably, each of these steps is currently barricaded by strict regulations and bans. In 2009, after a prolonged ban on federally funded research on ES cells, the Obama administration lifted the injunction on the derivation of new ES cells in the United States. But even with the new regulations, the NIH categorically prohibits two kinds of research on human ES cells. First, scientists are not permitted to introduce these cells into humans or animals to enable their development into live embryos. And second, genome modifications on ES cells cannot be performed in circumstances that might be transmitted into the germline, that is, into sperm or egg cells. In the spring of 2015, as I completed this book, a group of scientists, including Jennifer Doudna and David Baltimore, issued a joint statement seeking a moratorium on the use of gene editing and gene-altering technologies in the clinical setting, and particularly in human ES cells. The possibility of human germline engineering has long been a source of excitement and unease among the general public, especially in light of concerns about initiating a slippery slope from disease-curing applications toward uses with less compelling or even troubling implications, the moratorium reads. A key point of discussion is whether the treatment or cure of severe diseases in humans would be a responsible use of genome engineering, and if so, under what circumstances. For example, would it be appropriate to use the technology to change a disease-causing genetic mutation to a sequence more typical among healthy people? Even this seemingly straightforward scenario raises serious concerns, because there are limits to our knowledge of human genetics, gene-environment interactions, and the pathways of disease. Many scientists find the call for a moratorium understandable, even necessary. Gene editing, the stem cell biologist George Daly noted, raises the most fundamental of issues about how we are going to view our humanity in the future, and whether we are going to take the dramatic step of modifying our own germline, and, in a sense, take control of our genetic destiny, which raises enormous peril for humanity. In many ways, the proposed scheme of restrictions is reminiscent of the Asilomar moratorium. It seeks to limit the use of technology until the ethical, political, social, and legal implications of the technology can be ascertained. It calls for a public appraisal of the science and its future. It is also a frank acknowledgement of how tantalizingly close we are to making embryos with permanently altered human genomes. It is very clear that people will try to do gene editing in humans, Rudolf Janisch, the MIT biologist who created the first mouse embryos from ES cells, said. We need some principled agreement that we want to enhance humans in this way, or we don't. The word to watch in that last sentence is enhance, for it signals a radical departure from the conventional limits of genomic engineering. Prior to the invention of genome editing technologies, techniques such as embryo selection allowed us to cull information away from the human genome. By selecting embryos via pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, PGD, the Huntington's disease mutation or the cystic fibrosis mutation could be eliminated from a particular family's lineage. CRISPR-Cas9-based genomic engineering, in contrast, allows us to add information to the genome. A gene can be changed in an intentional manner, and a new genetic code can be written into the human genome. This reality means that germline manipulation would largely be justified by attempts to improve ourselves, Francis Collins wrote to me. That means that someone is empowered to decide what an improvement is. Anyone contemplating such action should be aware of their hubris. The crux, then, is not genetic emancipation, freedom from the bounds of hereditary illnesses, but genetic enhancement, freedom from the current boundaries of form and fate encoded by the human genome. The distinction between the two is the fragile pivot on which the future of genome editing whirls. If one man's illness is another man's normalcy, as this history teaches us, then one person's understanding of enhancement may be another's conception of emancipation. Why not make ourselves a little better, as Watson asks? But can humans responsibly enhance our own genomes? What are the consequences of augmenting the natural information encoded by our genes? Can we make our genomes a little better without risking the possibility of making ourselves substantially worse? In the spring of 2015, a laboratory in China announced that it had casually crossed the barricade. At the Sun Yat-sen University in Guangzhou, a team led by Junjui Huang obtained 86 human embryos from an IVF clinic and tried to use the CRISPR-Cas9 system to correct a gene responsible for a common blood disorder. Only embryos that were non-viable in the long term were chosen. 71 embryos survived. Of the 54 embryos tested, only 4 were found to have the corrected gene inserted. More portentously, The system was found to have inaccuracies. In one-third of all the embryos tested, unintentional mutations in other genes were also introduced, including mutations in genes essential for normal development and survival. The experiment was stopped. It was a daring, if slapdash, experiment meant to provoke a response, and it did. Around the world, scientists reacted to the attempted modification of a human embryo with extreme anguish and concern. The highest-ranking scientific journals, including Nature, Cell, and Science, refused to publish the results, citing broad violations of safety and ethical concerns. The results were eventually published in a scarcely read online journal, Protein Plus Cell. Yet, even as they read the study with apprehension and horror, biologists already knew that this was just the first step past the breach point. The Chinese researchers had taken the shortest route to permanent human genome engineering, and, predictably, the embryos had been littered with unforeseen mutations. But the technique could be modified with multiple variations to make it potentially more efficient and accurate. If embryonic stem cells and stem cell-derived sperm and eggs had been used, for instance, these cells could have been screened up front to cull away any deleterious mutations, and the efficiency of gene targeting might have been greatly increased. Zhen Jiuhuang told a journalist that he was planning to decrease the number of off-target mutations using different strategies, tweaking the enzymes to guide them more precisely to the desired spot, introducing the enzymes in a different format that could help to regulate their lifespans and thus allow them to be shut down before mutations accumulate. In a few months, he hoped to attempt another variation of the experiment. This time, he expected, with much higher efficiency and fidelity. He was not exaggerating. The technology to modify the genome of a human embryo may be complex, inefficient, and inaccurate, but it does not lie out of scientific reach. While scientists in the West continue to watch Zhen Jiuhuang's experiments on human embryos with justified apprehension, Chinese scientists are far more sanguine about such experiments. "I don't think China wants to take a moratorium," one scientist reported in the New York Times in late June 2015. A Chinese bioethicist clarified, "Confucian thinking says someone becomes a person after they are born. That is different from the United States and other countries with a Christian influence, where because of religion they may feel research on embryos is not okay. Our red line here is that you can only experiment on embryos that are younger than 14 days old." Another scientist wrote of the Chinese approach, "Do first, think later." Several public commentators seem to agree with this strategy. In the comments section of the New York Times, readers advocated lifting the bans on human genomic engineering and urged a ramp up in experimentation in the West, in part to remain competitive with the efforts in Asia. The Chinese experiments had evidently raised the stakes throughout the world. As one writer put it, "If we don't do this work, China will." The drive to change the genome of a human embryo has turned into an intercontinental arms race. As of this writing, four other groups in China are reportedly working on introducing permanent mutations in human embryos. By the time this book is published, I would not be surprised if the first successful targeted genome modification of a human embryo had been achieved in a laboratory. The first post-genomic human might be on his or her way to being born. We need a manifesto, or at least a hitchhiker's guide, for a post-genomic world. The historian Tony Jutt once told me that Albert Camus' novel The Plague was about the plague in the same sense that King Lear is about a king named Lear. In The Plague, a biological cataclysm becomes the testing ground for our fallibilities, desires, and ambitions. You cannot read The Plague except as a thinly disguised allegory of human nature. The genome is also a testing ground for our fallibilities and desires, although reading it does not require understanding allegories or metaphors. What we read and write into our genome is our fallibilities, desires, and ambitions. It is human nature. The task of writing that complete manifesto belongs to another generation, but perhaps we can scribe its opening salvos by recalling the scientific, philosophical, and moral lessons of this history. 1. A gene is the basic unit of hereditary information. It carries the information needed to build, maintain, and repair organisms. Genes collaborate with other genes, with inputs from the environment, with triggers, and with random chance to produce the ultimate form and function of an organism. Two, the genetic code is universal. A gene from a blue whale can be inserted into a microscopic bacterium, and it will be deciphered accurately and with nearly perfect fidelity. A corollary, there is nothing particularly special about human genes. Three, genes influence form, function, and fate, but these influences typically do not occur in a one-to-one manner. Most human attributes are the consequence of more than one gene. Many are the result of collaborations between genes, environments, and chance. Most of these interactions are non-systematic. That is, they occur through the intersection between a genome and fundamentally unpredictable events. And some genes tend to influence only propensities and tendencies. We can thus reliably predict the ultimate effect of a mutation or variation on an organism for only a minor subset of genes. 4. Variations in genes contribute to variations in features, forms, and behaviors. When we use the colloquial terms gene for blue eyes or gene for height, we are really referring to a variation or allele that specifies an eye color or height. These variations constitute an extremely minor portion of the genome. They are magnified in our imagination because of cultural and possibly biological tendencies that tend to amplify differences. A 6-foot man from Denmark and a 4-foot man from Demba share the same anatomy, physiology, and biochemistry. Even the two most extreme human variants, male and female, share 99.688% of their genes. 5. When we claim to find genes for certain human features or functions, it is by virtue of defining that feature narrowly. It makes sense to define genes for blood type or genes for height, since these biological attributes have intrinsically narrow definitions. But it is an old sin of biology to confuse the definition of a feature with the feature itself. If we define beauty as having blue eyes and only blue eyes, then we will indeed find a gene for beauty. If we define intelligence as the performance on only one kind of problem in only one kind of test, then we will indeed find a gene for intelligence. The genome is only a mirror for the breadth or narrowness of human imagination. It is Narcissus reflected. 6. It is nonsense to speak about nature or nurture in absolutes or abstracts. Whether nature, that is the gene, or nurture, that is the environment, dominates in the development of a feature or function depends acutely on the individual feature and the context. The SRY gene determines sexual anatomy and physiology in a strikingly autonomous manner. It is all nature. Gender identity, sexual preference, and the choice of sexual roles are determined by intersections of genes and environments, that is, nature plus nurture. The manner in which masculinity versus femininity is enacted or perceived in a society, in contrast, is largely determined by an environment, social memory, history, and culture. This is all nurture. 7. Every generation of humans will produce variants and mutants. It is an inextricable part of our biology. A mutation is only abnormal in a statistical sense. It is the less common variant. The desire to homogenize and normalize humans must be counterbalanced against biological imperatives to maintain diversity and abnormalcy. Normalcy is the antithesis of evolution. 8. Many human diseases, including several illnesses previously thought to be related to diet, exposure, environment, and chance, are powerfully influenced or caused by genes. Most of these diseases are polygenic, that is, influenced by multiple genes. These illnesses are heritable, that is, caused by the intersection of a particular permutation of genes, but not easily inheritable, that is, likely to be transmitted intact to the next generation, since the permutations of genes are remixed in each generation. Instances of each single gene, monogenic disease, are rare, but in some, they turn out to be surprisingly common. More than 10,000 such diseases have been defined thus far. Between 1 in 100 and 1 in 200 children will be born with a monogenic disease. 9. Every genetic illness is a mismatch between an organism's genome and its environment. In some cases, the appropriate medical intervention to mitigate a disease might be to alter the environment to make it fit an organismal form, building alternative architectural realms for those with dwarfism, imagining alternative educational landscapes for children with autism. In other cases, conversely, it might mean changing genes to fit environments. In yet other cases, the match may be impossible to achieve. The severest forms of genetic illnesses, such as those caused by non-function of essential genes, are incompatible with all environments. It is a peculiar modern fallacy to imagine that the definitive solution to illness is to change nature, that is, genes, when the environment is often more malleable. 10. In exceptional cases, the genetic incompatibility may be so deep that only extraordinary measures, such as genetic selection or directed genetic interventions, are justified. Until we understand the many unintended consequences of selecting genes and modifying genomes, it is safer to categorize such cases as exceptions rather than rules. 11. There is nothing about genes or genomes that makes them inherently resistant to chemical and biological manipulation. The standard notion that most human features are the result of complex gene-environment interactions and most are the result of multiple genes is absolutely true. But while these complexities constrain the ability to manipulate genes, they leave plenty of opportunity for potent forms of gene modification. Master regulators that affect dozens of genes are common in human biology. An epigenetic modifier may be designed to change the state of hundreds of genes with a single switch. The genome is replete with such nodes of intervention. 12. A triangle of considerations, extraordinary suffering, highly penetrant genotypes, and justifiable interventions has, thus far, constrained our attempts to intervene on humans. As we loosen the boundaries of this triangle by changing the standards for extraordinary suffering or justifiable interventions, we need new biological, cultural, and social precepts to determine which genetic interventions may be permitted or constrained, and the circumstances in which these interventions become safe or permissible. 13. History repeats itself, in part because the genome repeats itself, and the genome repeats itself in part because history does. The impulses, ambitions, fantasies, and desires that drive human history are, at least in part, encoded in the human genome. And human history has, in turn, selected genomes that carry these impulses, ambitions, fantasies, and desires. This self-fulfilling circle of logic is responsible for some of the most magnificent and evocative qualities in our species, but also some of the most reprehensible. It is far too much to ask ourselves to escape the orbit of this logic, but recognizing its inherent circularity and being skeptical of its overreach might protect the weak from the will of the strong and the mutant from being annihilated by the normal. Perhaps even that skepticism exists somewhere in our 21,000 genes. Perhaps the compassion that such skepticism enables is also encoded indelibly in the human genome. Perhaps it is part of what makes us human. Epilogue. Beta Abeta. Show me that you can divide the notes of a song, but first show me that you can discern between what can be divided and what cannot. An anonymous musical composition inspired by a classical Sanskrit poem. Abed, my father had called genes, indivisible. Bed, the opposite, is its own kaleidoscope of a word, to discriminate, in its verb form, to excise, to determine, to discern, to divide, to cure. It shares linguistic roots with vidya, knowledge, and with ved, medicine. The Hindu scriptures, the Vedas, acquired their name from the same root. It arises from the ancient Indo-European word vid, to know or to discern meaning. Scientists divide. We discriminate. It is the inevitable occupational hazard of our profession that we must break the world into its constituent parts, genes, atoms, bytes, before making it whole again. We know of no other mechanism to understand the world. To create the sum of the parts, we must begin by dividing it into the parts of the sum. But there is a hazard implicit in this method. Once we perceive organisms, humans, as assemblages built from genes, environments, and gene-environment interactions, our view of humans is fundamentally changed. No sane biologist believes that we are entirely the product of their genes, Berg told me. But once you bring genes into the picture, then our perception of ourselves can no longer be the same. A whole assembled from the sum of the parts is different from the whole before it was broken into the parts. As the poem in Sanskrit goes, "Show me that you can divide the notes of a song, but first show me that you can discern between what can be divided and what cannot." Three enormous projects lie ahead for human genetics. All three concern discrimination, division, and eventual reconstruction. The first is to discern the exact nature of information coded in the human genome. The Human Genome Project provided the starting point for this inquiry, but it raised a series of intriguing questions about what precisely is encoded by the 3 billion nucleotides of human DNA. What are the functional elements in the genome? There are protein-coding genes, of course, about 21 to 24,000 in all, but also regulatory sequences of genes and stretches of DNA, introns, that split genes into modules. There is information to build tens of thousands of RNA molecules that do not get translated into proteins, but still seem to perform diverse roles in cellular physiology. There are long highways of junk DNA that are unlikely to be junk after all and may encode hundreds of yet unknown functions. There are kinks and folds that allow one part of the chromosome to associate with another part in three-dimensional space. To understand the role of each of these elements, a vast international project, launched in 2013, hopes to create a compendium of every functional element in the human genome, that is, any part of any sequence in any chromosome that has a coding or instructional function. Ingeniously termed the Encyclopedia of DNA Elements, ENCODE, this project will cross-annotate the sequence of the human genome against all the information contained within it. Once these functional elements have been identified, biologists can move to the second challenge, understanding how the elements can be combined in time and space to enable human embryology and physiology, the specification of anatomical parts, and the development of an organism's unique features and characteristics. One humbling fact about our understanding of the human genome is how little we know of the human genome. Much of our knowledge of our genes and their functions is inferred from similar-looking genes in yeast, worms, flies, and mice. As David Botstein writes, very few human genes have been studied directly. Part of the task of the new genomics is to close the gap between mice and men, to determine how human genes function in the context of the human organism. For medical genetics, this project promises several particularly important payoffs. The functional annotation of the human genome will enable biologists to discover novel mechanisms of illness. New genomic elements will be linked to complex medical diseases. We still do not know, for instance, how the intersection between genetic information, behavioral exposures, and random chance causes hypertension, schizophrenia, depression, obesity, cancer, or heart disease. Finding the correct functional elements in the genome that are linked to these diseases is the first step to solving the mechanisms by which they arise. Understanding these links will also reveal the predictive power of the human genome. In an influential review published in 2011, the psychologist Eric Turkheimer wrote, "A century of familial studies of twins, siblings, parents and children, adoptees, and whole pedigrees has established beyond the shadow of a doubt that genes play a crucial role in the explanation of all human differences, from the medical to the normal, the biological to the behavioral. Yet despite the strengths of these links, the genetic world, as Turkheimer calls it, has proved much more difficult to map and deconvolute than expected. Until recently, the only genetic changes that were powerfully predictive of future illnesses were those with high penetrance that caused the severest of phenotypes. Combinations of gene variants were particularly difficult to decipher. It was impossible to determine how a particular permutation of genes, that is a genotype, would determine a particular outcome in the future, that is phenotype, especially if that outcome was governed by a multitude of genes. But this barrier might soon collapse. Imagine a thought experiment that might seem far-fetched at first glance. Suppose we could comprehensively sequence the genomes of 100,000 children prospectively, that is, before anything is known about the future of any child, and create a database of all the variations and combinations of the functional elements of each child's genome. 100,000 is an arbitrary number. The experiment can be extended to any number of children. Imagine now creating a fate map of this cohort of children. Every illness or physiological aberrancy identified and recorded on a parallel database. We might describe this map as a human phenome, the full set of all phenotypes, attributes, features, behaviors of an individual. And now imagine a computational engine that mines the data from these gene map fate map pairs to determine how one might predict the other. Despite remnant uncertainties, even deep ones, the prospective mapping of 100,000 human genomes to 100,000 human phenomes would provide an extraordinary data set. It would begin to describe the nature of fate that is encoded by a genome. The extraordinary feature of this fate map is that it need not be restricted to illness. It can be as wide and deep and detailed as we would like it to be. It could include the low birth weight of a child, a learning disability in preschool, the transient tumult of a particular adolescence, a teenage infatuation, an impulsive marriage, coming out, infertility, a midlife crisis, a propensity for addiction, a cataract in the left eye, premature baldness, depression, a heart attack, an early death from ovarian cancer or breast cancer. Such an experiment would have been inconceivable in the past, but the combined power of computing technology, data storage, and gene sequencing has made it conceivable in the future. It is a gargantuan twin study, except without twins. Millions of virtual genetic twins are created computationally by matching genomes across space and time, and these permutations are then annotated against life events. It's important to recognize the inherent limitations of such projects, or, more generally, of trying to predict diseases and destinies from genomes. Perhaps, as one observer complained, the fate of genetic explanations will culminate in decontextualizing etiological processes, underrepresenting the role of environments, producing some stunning medical interventions, but revealing little about the fate of populations. But the power of such studies is precisely that they decontextualize illness. Genes provide the context to understand development and fate. Situations that are context-dependent or environment-dependent get diluted and filtered out, and only those powerfully affected by genes remain. With enough subjects and enough computational power, nearly all of the predictive capacity of the genome can, in principle, be determined and computed. The final project is perhaps the most far-reaching. As much as the ability to predict human phenomes from human genomes was limited by the lack of computational technologies, the ability to intentionally change human genomes was bounded by the paucity of biological technologies. Gene delivery methods such as viruses were inefficient and unreliable at best, and lethal at worst, and intentional gene delivery into the human embryo was virtually impossible. These barriers, too, have started to collapse. Novel gene editing technologies now allow geneticists to make remarkably precise alterations in the human genome with equally remarkable specificity. In principle, a single letter of DNA can be mutated to another letter in a directional manner, leaving the 3 billion other bases of the genome largely untouched. This technology might be likened to a copy editing device that scans 66 volumes of the Encyclopedia Britannica and finds, erases, and changes one word, leaving all other words untouched. Between 2010 and 2014, a postdoctoral researcher in my laboratory tried to introduce a defined genetic change into a cell line using the standard gene delivery viruses, but with little success. In 2015, having switched to the new CRISPR-based technology, she engineered 14 alterations of genes in 14 human genomes, including the genomes of human embryonic stem cells, in 6 months, a feat unimaginable in the past. Geneticists and gene therapists around the world are currently exploring the possibility of changing the human genome with renewed verve and urgency, in part because the current technologies have brought us to a precipice. A combination of stem cell technologies, nuclear transfer, and epigenetic modulation and gene editing methods has made it conceivable that the human genome can be broadly manipulated and that transgenic humans can be created. We have no knowledge of the fidelity or efficiency of these techniques in practice. Does making an intentional change in a gene run the risk of creating an unintended change in another part of the genome? Are some genes more easily edited than others? And what governs the pliability of a gene? Nor do we know whether making a directed change in one gene might cause the entire genome to become dysregulated. If some genes are indeed recipes, as in Dawkins' formulation, then altering one gene may cause far-reaching consequences for gene regulation, potentially unleashing a volley of downstream consequences, akin to the proverbial butterfly effect. If such butterfly effect genes are common in the genome, then they will represent fundamental limitations for gene editing technologies. The discontinuity of genes, the discreteness and autonomy of each individual unit of heredity, will turn out to be an illusion. Genes may yet be more interconnected than we think. But first, show me that you can discern between what can be divided and what cannot. Imagine, then, a world in which these technologies can be routinely deployed. When a child is conceived, every parent is given the choice of testing the fetus using comprehensive genome sequencing in utero. Mutations that cause the most severe impairments are identified, and parents are given the option of aborting such fetuses at the earliest stages of pregnancy or selectively implanting only the normal fetuses after comprehensive genetic screening. We might call this comprehensive pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, or CPGD. More complex combinations of genes that might cause tendencies toward disease are also identified by genome sequencing. When children with such predicted tendencies are born, they are offered selective interventions throughout childhood. A child with a predilection toward a genetic form of obesity, for instance, might be monitored for changes in body mass, treated with an alternative diet, or metabolically reprogrammed using hormones, drugs, or genetic therapies in childhood. A child with a tendency for an attention deficit or hyperactivity syndrome might undergo behavioral therapy or be placed in an enriched classroom. If and when the illnesses do emerge or advance, gene-based therapies are deployed to treat or cure them. Corrected genes are delivered directly into the affected tissues. The functioning cystic fibrosis gene, for instance, is aerosolized and injected into the lungs of patients, where it partially restores the normal function of the lung. A girl born with ADA deficiency is transplanted with bone marrow stem cells carrying the correct gene. For more complex genetic diseases, genetic diagnostics are combined with genetic therapies, with drugs, and with environment therapies. Cancers are comprehensively analyzed by documenting the mutations responsible for driving malignant growth of one particular cancer. These mutations are used to identify culprit pathways that fuel the growth of cells and to devise exquisitely targeted therapies to kill malignant cells and spare normal cells. Imagine you are a soldier returning from war with PTSD, the psychiatrist Richard Friedman wrote in the New York Times in 2015. With a simple blood test looking at gene variants, we could discover whether you were biologically adept at fear extinction. If you had a mutation that reduced your ability to extinguish fear, your therapist would know you might just need more exposure, more treatment sessions to recover. Or, perhaps, a different therapy altogether that doesn't rely on exposure, like interpersonal therapy or medication. Perhaps drugs that can erase epigenetic marks are prescribed in combination with talk therapy. Perhaps the erasure of cellular memories can ease the erasure of historical memories. Genetic diagnoses and genetic interventions are also used to screen and correct mutations in human embryos. When intervenable mutations in certain genes are identified in the germline, parents are given the choice of genetic surgery to alter their sperm and eggs before conception, or prenatal screening of embryos to avoid implanting mutant embryos in the first place. Genes that cause the most detrimental variants of illness are thus excised from the human genome up front by positive or negative selection, or by genome modification. If you listen to that scenario carefully, it inspires both wonder and a certain moral queasiness. The individual interventions may not push the boundaries of transgression. Indeed, some, such as the targeted treatment of cancer, schizophrenia, and cystic fibrosis, represent landmark goals for medicine, but aspects of this world seem distinctly and even repulsively alien. It is a world inhabited by previvors and post-humans, men and women who have been screened for genetic vulnerabilities or created with altered genetic propensities. Illness might progressively vanish, but so might identity. Grief might be diminished, but so might tenderness. Traumas might be erased, but so might history. Mutants would be eliminated, but so would human variation. Infirmities might disappear, but so might vulnerability. Chance would become mitigated, but so, inevitably, would choice. In 1990, writing about the Human Genome Project, the worm geneticist John Sulston wondered about the philosophical quandary raised by an intelligent organism that has learned to read its own instructions. But an infinitely deeper quandary is raised when an intelligent organism learns to write its own instructions. If genes determine the nature and fate of an organism, and if organisms now begin to determine the nature and fate of their genes, then the circle of logic closes on itself. Once we start thinking of genes as destiny, manifest, then it is inevitable to begin imagining the human genome as manifest destiny. On the way back from Moni's institution in Calcutta, my father wanted to stop again outside the house where he had grown up, the place where they had brought Rajesh back in the throes of his mania, thrashing like a wild bird. We drove in silence. His memories had formed the walls of a room around him. We left the car at the narrow inlet of Hyatt Khan Lane and walked into the cul-de-sac on foot. It was about 6 in the evening. The houses were lit by an oblique, smoky light, and the air threatened rain. "Bengalis have only one event in their history, partition," my father said. He was looking up at the balconies jutting above us and trying to recall the names of his former neighbors. Ghosh, Talukdar, Mukherjee, Chatterjee, Shen. A gentle drizzle began to descend on us, or perhaps it was just the drippings from the laundry hanging thickly on clotheslines tacked across the houses. "Partition was the defining event for every man and woman in this city," he said. "Either you lost your own home, or your home became a shelter for someone else." He pointed to the colonnades of windows above our heads. Every family here had another family living within it. They were households within households, rooms inside rooms, microcosms lodged inside microcosms. When we arrived here from Barishal, with our 4 steel trunks and our few salvaged possessions, we thought we were beginning a new life. We had experienced a catastrophe, but it was also a fresh start. Every house on that street I knew had its own story of steel trunks and salvaged possessions. It was as if all the inhabitants had been equalized, like a garden cut back to the roots in the winter. For a cohort of men, including my father, the journey from east to west Bengal involved a radical resetting of all clocks. Thus began year zero. Time was splintered into 2 halves, the era before the cataclysm and the era after, BP and AP. This vivisection of history, the partition of partition, produced a strangely dissonant experience. The men and women of my father's generation perceived themselves as unwitting participants in a natural experiment. Once the clocks had been reset to zero, it was as if you could watch the lives, fates, and choices of human beings played out from some starting gate or from the beginning of time. My father had experienced this experiment all too acutely. One brother had devolved into mania and depression. Another sense of reality had been shattered. My grandmother had acquired her lifelong suspicion of all forms of change. My father had acquired his taste for adventure. It seemed as if distant futures, like homunculi, had been folded into each person, waiting to be unfurled. What force or mechanism might explain such widely divergent fates and choices of individual human beings? In the 18th century, an individual's destiny was commonly described as a series of events ordained by God. Hindus had long believed that a person's fate was derived, with near arithmetic precision, by some calculus of the good and evil acts that he had performed in a previous life. God, in this scheme, was a glorified moral tax accountant, tallying and divvying out portions of good and bad fate based on past investments and losses. The Christian God, capable of inexplicable compassion and equally inexplicable wrath, was a more mercurial bookkeeper, but he too was the ultimate, if more inscrutable, arbiter of destiny. 19th and 20th century medicine offered more secular conceptions of fate and choice. Illness, perhaps the most concrete and universal of all acts of fate, could now be described in mechanistic terms, not as the arbitrary visitation of divine vengeance, but as the consequence of risks, exposures, predispositions, conditions, and behaviors. Choice was understood as an expression of an individual's psychology, experiences, memories, traumas, and personal history. By the mid-20th century, identity, affinity, temperament, and preference, straightness versus gayness or impulsivity versus caution, were increasingly described as phenomena caused by the intersections of psychological impulses, personal histories, and random chance. An epidemiology of destiny and choice was born. In the early decades of the 21st century, we are learning to speak yet another language of cause and effect, and constructing a new epidemiology of self. We are beginning to describe illness, identity, affinity, temperament, preferences, and ultimately fate and choice in terms of genes and genomes. This is not to make the absurd claim that genes are the only lenses through which fundamental aspects of our nature and destiny can be viewed, but it is to propose and to give serious consideration to one of the most provocative ideas about our history and future, that the influence of genes on our lives and beings is richer, deeper, and more unnerving than we had imagined. This idea becomes even more provocative and destabilizing as we learn to interpret, alter, and manipulate the genome intentionally, thereby acquiring the ability to alter future fates and choices. Nature may, after all, be entirely approachable, Thomas Morgan wrote in 1919. Her much-advertised inscrutability has once more been found to be an illusion. We are now trying to extend Morgan's conclusions, not just to nature, but to human nature. I have often thought about the possible trajectories of Jagu's and Rajesh's lives if they had been born in the future, say 50 or 100 years from now. Would our knowledge of their heritable vulnerabilities be used to find cures for the illnesses that had devastated their lives? Would that knowledge be used to normalize them? And if so, what moral, social, and biological hazards would that entail? Would such forms of knowledge enable new kinds of empathy and understanding? Or would they nucleate novel forms of discrimination? Would the knowledge be used to redefine what is natural? But what is natural, I wonder? On one hand, variation, mutation, change, inconstancy, divisibility, flux, and on the other, constancy, permanence, indivisibility, fidelity, bed, a bed. It should hardly surprise us that DNA, the molecule of contradictions, encodes an organism of contradictions. We see constancy in heredity and find its opposite, variation. Mutants are necessary to maintain the essence of ourselves. Our genome has negotiated a fragile balance between counterpoised forces, pairing strand with opposing strand, mixing past and future, pitting memory against desire. It is the most human of all things that we possess. Its stewardship may be the ultimate test of knowledge and discernment for our species.
The Gene, An Intimate History, was written by Siddhartha Mukherjee and read by Dennis Boutsakaris. It was recorded by Elia Einhorn and Erica Weintraub at Simon & Schuster in New York City. Editing and post-production by Frog Pond Productions. Terry Hogan was the mix engineer. The associate producer was Michael Noble. The Gene was produced and directed by Tara Thomas. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. The Gene, An Intimate History, is available in print from Scribner. Also from Simon & Schuster Audio, The Emperor of All Maladies by Siddhartha Mukherjee, read by Fred Sanders, and The Laws of Medicine by Siddhartha Mukherjee, read by Santino Fontana.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.